Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Wednesday, September 7th. I'm Ray Graff. If you are in the market for a new home or if you plan on selling your property, you are in the right place at the right time. We have two real estate pros in the studio to answer your questions. Alex Monticello of Monticello Real Estate and Renata Lewis, who just walked in, of Keller Williams Capital District, are waiting for your questions. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Yes, the interest rates are a little higher. These two do not look worried. They'll explain why. The number again is 800-348-2551. Renata, Alex, and your real estate calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk real estate every so often on this program. Today is the day. Alex Monticello of Monticello Real Estate joins us. He specializes in residential sales for buyers and sellers in the Capital Region. Also here is Renata Lewis from Keller Williams Capital District, who also leads the Renata V. Lewis team. She is a go-to source for real estate and industry insight and advice. You got a question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is the number. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Our guests are loaded for bear today. Renata in particular is especially wound up. So this should be one heck of a fun show. 800-348-2551 is the number. Renata Lewis, what's gotten into you?
Nothing. Everything's great.
Okay, well, you know.
It's all good.
All right. No, you seem, everything seems okay, but you got a little high energy. Are you drinking the energy drinks now?
No, just coffee.
All right, fair enough. Hey, Alex, how are you? How's the summer going?
Good. I think it's over.
No, it's not over. It's not over.
All right.
Speaking of denial, interest rates, they're ticking up. Now, we're what, 6% nationally for the average? When do the real estate pros start getting scared?
This is what we were talking about. So listen, this is on average, historically, 6% is the average interest rate that we see and that has been recorded. So this is not a catastrophe. We know buyers and sellers that we speak with that have paid 18%, 20% interest rates. So it's just really, you're going to prepare a little bit more and make sure that the budget and the monthly mortgage makes sense for you. So just having a really strong conversation of where are you financially, what kind of plan do we need to put you in, and what works.
So 6% is not the end of the world. Alex, you and Renato are just talking, and you know most of the stuff you say, I have no idea. I'm just listening with half an ear. But you said something about a 40 or 50-year mortgage. This, to me, sounds like something new, but maybe it's not.
You know, it's I haven't seen it in the last 10 years, but there are some local banks now in the Capital Region that are doing 40-year mortgages. So that can be really helpful to the buyer who, because of the rise in interest rates, you know, on a $400,000 home, that house is now costing about $650 more a month for that buyer than it did about 12 months ago.
Right.
So the 40-year mortgage will help to stretch out. We also were talking about the variable rate mortgages, which those interest rates are about a point and a half below what the 30-year fixed rate mortgage is today.
Now, the variable rate, I find, to me, it seems vexing because, yeah, it may be good when the interest rates go down, but they could still go up. I mean, Renata just talked about 18, 20% back in the day.
Correct. However, the variable rate mortgage, they can be fixed for a period of time. 5, 7, 10 years. And as we talked about, you know, most people move every 7 years. It's very likely, I would take a point and a half less today, knowing that I've got 10 years to refinance. Odds are pretty good that over the next 10 years, rates will be below what they are today.
So, Renata, I mean, when we talk about a 40-year mortgage or a 30-year mortgage, most people are never going to get to the end of that, right?
True, true. So that was the conversation we were having. Most people will want to move within the first 7 to 10 years is on average that we hear. And even if you don't move at that point, you're watching those interest rates and you're either refinancing and or buying a new home if you do move. So there's always options. And again, I mean, we are comparing mortgage rates with rents right now, and rents are very high. So if you're paying a, you know, $2,500 rent, $3,000 rent, you could easily afford a mortgage payment. However, just getting you qualified, you know, the debt to credit ratios, you know, the banks are still very tight as far as, you know, approving you and making sure that the risk is not too high on their end.
Oh, okay. So this is not, in your estimation, a pre-bubble situation that happened, what, 10 years ago, 12
no.
years ago?
No, not at all.
The banks are being scrupulous about
always.
This.
Always. Throughout this entire last 3-4 years, the banks have been very, very careful on who they're lending their money to. So, again, the appreciation. So, I mean, I was just at a big convention, and I just kind of wanted to talk about appreciation. So, in 2020, the prices appreciated 9%. In 2021, they appreciated 18%. 2022, they're coming down to 12%.
So we're the values of the home continue to rise.
Yes, so they were rising, but yet even though we may see a softening in some of the prices, we're still way above where the prices were 5 years ago. So as far as, you know, you're still building equity. If you're moving from one home to another, you have built a lot of equity in your home. So even though your new purchase may cost you a little bit more, think about what equity you have to work with and does it make sense? So there is just a lot of different options, and for everyone is going to be a little bit different.
Renata Lewis is here, Alex Monticello as well. It's Real Estate Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Alex, we were talking briefly before the show began about inventories and the market here regionally. You seem pretty confident things are still in a good spot.
Well, we still have historically low inventory. And that's so despite the fact that rates have risen so much and the home purchase has become more expensive for most home buyers, there's still a lack of inventory. You know, we're at 2 months supply of inventory, where traditionally they would say 5 to 6 months supply is a balanced market. And there was always many, many more buyers for every one house. There's less buyers for every house, but there's, you know, still we're finding buyers out there willing to pay top dollar, even with the rise in interest rates.
Now, I don't know how often you track these or you recalibrate these, Renata, but what is the average time a home will be on the market now in this market?
So that's really going to depend, especially in this market, because we are in a shifting market right now. It's going to depend on the neighborhood, but you know, individual areas. We're still seeing below average days on markets right now.
Yet, what's the average?
The average in Delmar, in the Bethlehem area.
Yeah, or anywhere, you know, around here.
I mean, so it's
different from
town
to town.
It's different from town to town, yes. So, I mean, we're looking anywhere between 12 to maybe 25 days on the market in the Albany County area. Yet, the challenging part of this is, and we're talking to different economists and just trying to project what the market's going to look like within the next 6 years, a year, 2 years from now. So, yes, we do have low inventory that's out there still. However, the prices are coming down. So it's a little challenging for us to really figure out what that magic number is as far as pricing a home. You know, again, the days on the market are shorter, the inventory supply is still low, yet we are not appreciating as far as the rise in the pricing of the homes. So the challenge is, no, we cannot sell your house anymore, possibly as far as what your neighbor may have sold for. Yet,
a year ago,
think about what the overall appreciation over the last 3 years have happened. You're still selling at a great price. Let's talk about what it's going to take to sell it and maybe still put it on the market aggressively so we could still get the multiple offer situation.
See, now there's the relaxed Renata we all knew we'd see before the end of the show. Alex Monticello, Renata Lewis are here to take your questions on real estate. And let's grab one call here before the first break. 800-348-2551 is the number. David is in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes, thank you, Ray. Great show.
Thank you.
I am a senior citizen. I have a house that is too big for me. I'm rattling around in a big house. And I am in a quandary because I am poor, but I have a big house. But if I sell the house, I would be in a different tax bracket, and I would be losing benefits that I would normally enjoy, medical benefits and other benefits that would cost me and be putting me into a more negative situation. Do you have any advice for me?
David, I mean, first off, you'll want to talk to a tax professional, but generally speaking, if it's your if it's your primary home and it was used for residential purposes, the first $250,000 is of profit is tax-free. And if you if you're married, it's up to $500,000. So that means if you sell your primary home, that first $250,000 is not reported.
Additionally, and I don't, forgive me because I really don't know how it all works, but going into a trust or an estate could protect the money that you possibly are showing because it will be a separate entity. So that could be an option, and definitely research into that.
David?
Yes, thank you very much. It seems to me that working all your life to get a property and then you get sick and you go into a nursing home and everything goes to the government.
Isn't that something?
It seems counterproductive.
Yep. Well, David, I think that's another show. And, you know, there are some points to be made on both sides of that one. But we'll take a break here. And thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Don't get me started on the government. All right, we'll take a break. It's Real Estate, Alex and Renata. Your call's coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC, I think that's what, Derek and the Dominoes, or is it Eric Clapton on his own? I can't remember, but it's good. It's Clapton. All right, thank you, Zach the engineer. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Renata Lewis is here. Alex Monticello is here. And before we get to the email bag here, and we got a good one for you. You guys had mentioned how much it costs to rent now and how that has gone up. Is that a commensurate rise with values of properties that you purchase? And if not, why is rent going up so high and the housing prices are leveling at 12% increases or whatever?
It's a tough question, right?
It is a tough question.
You know, I don't have a good answer on the rental piece. I mean, I guess partly is there's just been you know, I think in light of COVID, there's been a lack of housing supply for many mm-hmm. years. Probably for a decade, we've been behind in terms of housing units and supply. And you know, I think during the pandemic, there may have been a pullback in building.
I think the cost of everything also. I mean, if you know, anytime if you're a landlord, you're, you know, whether it's the maintenance has gone up in price and. You know, just overall, you know, being a landlord has also increased. So they're taking that, just like building a house is a lot more money. Just materials are more money, labor is more money. So they're just trying to, their margins got really, really tight. And
that, so it's not gouging, which is what it appears to be to
I
me.
I don't think it is gouging. Obviously, their New York State laws protect a lot of the tenants and, you know, the increases that could happen. There is a lot of different changes that have happened over the last 3 years. But yeah, I mean, overall, I just think overall economy and the cost of everything has a good reason for the spike.
And, you know, you guys follow so much data in the real estate world. We see this as an indicator, and I don't know why it's less of an indicator or more of an indicator than existing homes, but why are new home starts so important to this whole equation?
Well, because the new home starts are necessary because they help add new inventory on the market.
That'll drive prices down ultimately, though, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct. But, I mean, less of an issue here, but certainly, you know, in Florida or some states where they have rapidly growing populations, new home starts are critical to keep up with the migration of people coming into those communities. And those have been backlog for, gosh, they've been talking about it for 6 or 8 years now, the fact that permits just haven't kept up with the required number of housing inventory.
Is there a ratio that you guys follow where you can predict the existing inventory trends by new home starts? Is there any ratio between the two that you follow?
I would just say the appreciation, the inventory days, the supply of inventory. What is that? Absorption rate, the absorption rate.
Yeah. I don't follow the new home starts.
Okay.
You know,
Alex, you look perplexed. You should know by now I ask dumb questions.
No, that's a tough question. I think that's an important question. In part because in this area, resale home construction is a much smaller percentage of the overall market in our area, but not the case in other markets.
Gotcha. Let's go to the email bag here. This one's from Kathleen in Poughkeepsie. How to be a cash buyer. I own my home outright. Plan to move to a city where the house prices are somewhat lower. I plan to do a cash purchase. Is there any reason not to do a cash purchase? Do I need to qualify myself as a cash buyer somehow? Any other advice? And that's from Kathleen in Poughkeepsie.
So, even as a cash buyer, when you're putting an offer in, you need to show proof of funds. So call your bank, tell your bank to write you a nice letter saying, hey, there's enough equity, X amount of money that's liquid that you will be using to purchase the home. So that's really important. Otherwise, we can't really sell that to the seller. Hey, this person is saying they're going to pay cash. If we can't prove it, then it's really a non-existing contract.
All right. But there are advantages to this? I mean, clearly there must be buying it outright.
Yeah. I mean, a big advantage, especially in this market, in paying cash from a seller's point of view is there's not going to be a bank or appraisal. And although we've been lucky, when you have a home that may sell 10-20% over the list price, that just increases the chance that there could be an appraisal issue. And the appraiser could disagree with the price that the buyer and the seller agreed to sell it for.
Yeah, you're technically eliminating that middle person, which is the bank.
Okay, let's go one more email and then back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Real Estate Today with Alex Monticello and Renata Lewis. This is from Mary in Wilbraham. We are empty nesters now, looking to list come the new year. Okay, that makes sense. What is typically the best month to list in an upper middle class, family oriented neighborhood? We were thinking of the 1st of January, but thought perhaps since it is a family neighborhood, maybe wait until spring is better. Do families move mid-year, or should we be waiting till school is out to capture more viewers / offers? We're comfortable, can afford to wait a few more months if it means more viewers. And that's from Mary and Wilbraham.
So that's a great question. A couple things. I always recommend if you're going to be selling between, say, May 15th and October 15th, if you're not going to be selling between those months, it's a good idea now to take pictures and video of the exterior of the house. Generally, the last few Januaries have been very busy. I think now the last three, first quarters of the year have been some of the best years to sell. We haven't seen a pullback in buyer demand, and there's sometimes even less inventory. Mm. So I think if you're ready, early January is probably a good time to put it on the market. But I would recommend taking the exterior photos and video now.
Why does everybody hate pictures of snow, Renata?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's pretty.
Yeah, snow, I like it too.
You know, Christmas, like lights. But just so piggyback what Alex was saying, as far as selling and what time is best, I always have that conversation that we know what the market looks like today. I don't know what it's going to look like a week from now, a month from now. And with the state of the economy, with everything that has happened, COVID, who predicted COVID, right? If you're thinking about selling, talk to a professional now, get all those pictures done and get it on the market. I mean, it's still a strong market. We're still seeing a lot of inventory moving. Even with the interest rates, there's always buyers that need to relocate, that need to buy. So I typically, December, January, February, even early March, we're seeing less of a buyer demand. However, the buyers that are out there are very strong ready to buy now buyers. Who wants to look at houses at 30 degree below weather, right? So those buyers are the ones that are going to be buying. Whereas we get into the spring market, we're going to have a lot more buyers out there, but they're not necessarily jumping to buy your house immediately because they want to maybe look a little bit more. So, but again, the last 2 years, we've had very little inventory, so the demand was high, yet we're seeing that demand come down a little bit. So we don't know what that spring market's going to be like.
But yet Alex says, and you also say, that inventory is still pretty low.
It is.
Doesn't it make sense to wait until you have more viewers and potentially get some competition?
Well, if inventory is low, why would you wait for inventory to go up?
But, right? No.
Now, if more sellers come to the market, now you have more competition, right?
Okay.
You want to sell with less inventory. And now we know we have less inventory. Who knows what the market's going to look like come next spring?
What do you think you have learned? And we'll get back to the phones in a minute. 800-348-2551. Hang in there just one more moment. What lessons can we take away from the massive upheaval to the economy and everything else that was the COVID pandemic? You know, real estate agents did all right. It wasn't exactly easy. But what lessons have we learned about the business and the economy in general? Alex, you first.
Well, you know, there's that saying, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago and the second best time to plant a tree is today, right? You know, the best time to buy a house was 20 years ago, but the second best time probably is going to be today. I think, you know, everybody's always worried they're buying at the top of the market. And I think in 2008, 2009, there were some valid concerns looking back. But I think what we're seeing is this is a very strong market. It's sustainable. It's real. And if you need to move or you're in the market to buy a house, you're probably better off doing it now rather than later. And goes to the same can be applied to if you're looking to renovate or do construction in your house. It's probably better to do it now than wait.
Until it falls down.
Until it falls down.
Which was always the question in our house. Wait till it falls down or you fix it. But Renata, has the game changed? Your day-to-day operation when you show a house, when you walk through a house, when you are listing or buying, are there any tweaks that have happened because of the way things changed with the economy and with the lockdown and the remote economy?
Absolutely. I mean, we had to learn so many new things. Technology became a huge factor in the way we're doing business, whether it was, you know, when COVID first hit, we couldn't even look inside the house. We were doing everything virtually. You know, we were FaceTiming our clients. So I sold more houses sight unseen during COVID that I've sold throughout my entire career. So, but overall, I think the urgency, the timing, you know, has shifted as well. Things needed to happen quickly. Things were moving very quickly. You know, I believe that there's going to be some buyer regret in the future because they bought homes that they compromised on, and it's only because they needed to secure a home for their family and they didn't have a lot of options. So I think that's going to come back to market eventually. But overall, we did what we could in hard times and in hardship times, and families moved. Families were able to place themselves in a neighborhood in the area that they wanted to. Some may not have had many options, so that could come back. However, overall, I mean, it was a crazy ride. Just the attorney approvals were very different. Things that we negotiated were very different. So just a lot of things that we would never do that happened over the last 2 years.
Anything that'll stick?
I think we're going back to a little bit of a normal.
It feels that way.
Yeah.
Until the next shoe drops. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Scott in New Lisbon, you're on. New Lisbon, where's that?
Hey, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I work around the ag industry, and a scenario that pops up sometimes is that people buy houses in agricultural districts, which are set aside, you know, for a lot of agriculture. And then you might have, like, maybe a farmer put in a field that he wants to start spreading manure on, or some sort of activity that upsets the new homeowner, and you get these terrible situations where people seem to be unaware of what an ag district is. So my question is, are real estate agents required to tell prospective buyers that they're looking at a house in an agricultural district? And what kind of information do you think that they provide the homeowner. You know, they might not know what that means to them in their purchase. Thank you very much.
Okay. Anybody?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the New York State Property Condition Disclosure Statement does require the homeowner to answer whether they are in an agricultural district or not. You know, so if a real estate agent is aware of it, they need to disclose to the parties that that's the case.
And I think that when you get into more of that homestead style areas and rural areas, there is a specific agriculture disclosure that I've seen. I don't work with many, but that will definitely disclose, you know, what farmlands are around and, you know, the type of farmlands that are around. I do believe that, again, in New York State, it's a buyer beware state. It is your due diligence as a buyer to do some research. If something's important to you, I have one home in the Greene County area where, you know, a lot of the buyers are seeking that home style, living off the land, off the grid. And the big question is, you know, who are my neighbors? What are they doing? Are they using any, you know, pesticides or anything that could potentially compromise my family? So it is an important question, but there is a lot of due diligence that does default on the buyer. Talk to your agent and make sure that you guys are doing that homework.
Scott.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I thought you might want to follow up, sir.
No, I thought that's a great answer. And I think you're right, of course, that they do need to do the research and be told. But beyond that, be told what that could possibly mean. I mean, for some rural homeowners, of course, the landscape is beautiful and that field across from your house is a gorgeous thing to look at. But, you know, one day that field might be a manure storage facility or a, you know, have or something like that spread on it. And the character of it might change. And that's when I see people seem to be caught unaware. And, you know, generally very upset and upset with the farmer, unfortunately, who's really just, you know, operating his business. So I was curious about that.
Hey,
thank you very much.
Scott, before you go, the only new Lisbon I know is in Jersey. Are you in New Jersey?
No. I'm from Otsego County. So, you know, that's like Oneonta, Cooperstown kind of area.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for calling. Great call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Real Estate with Renata and Alex. And we'll grab one more here before the next break. We go to Saratoga. Susan, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Hello. We just lost you. You're still there.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
You betcha. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. Thanks for taking my call, Ray, and the guest.
Sure.
You know, my question is, with the price of housing going up so much, and it's really, really out of control for the average working class family, I was paying rent in Saratoga Springs, you know, 13 years. I lost my home. I have a disabled son. I have a caregiver, you know, all that. And so they raised my rent $400. And, of course, I asked, well, maybe I can get a job and, you know, a second job and all that. And, of course, they wouldn't renew my lease because I wanted the place fixed up, and it was falling apart. So okay. What I did was I bought a modular home.
Okay.
And my rent would have gone – my house payment went from $2,200 to $900, including my finance, in a large lot with a brand-new trailer. I mean – I have crown molding that's 6 inches. It's gorgeous, okay?
Nice.
And my big question is, what do I do with all my friends that have lost their apartments and are almost homeless now that are my age, 65, because of this, what's going on with these landlords and the price of housing? Wall Street's got into it. 60 Minutes did it. I've been watching Wall Street. They've been buying these properties throughout the country and paying cash and then renting them out. So it's almost we're becoming very feudalistic in the sense that the middle class can't afford to buy a house and the middle class can't afford the property taxes and the middle class is going to become unable to pass wealth to the next generation.
I think that's an interesting point. I'd love to get the take of
my question is.
Go ahead.
My question is, when is this going to get controlled? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's very, very, very tough for people who make less than $70,000 a year, even to have a home.
To be
and
fair,
sometimes even a trailer.
To be fair, Susan, I'm not sure real estate agents are going to be able to answer this question. It's a rather huge question, but let's get your take on that before the break. Renata, we'll start with you.
So, I know. I mean, we talk to a lot of clients, and this what you're saying is we're hearing loud and clear. I wish there was more that we can do. There are affordable houses that are available for rent in many different areas. So that's definitely an avenue that people can check into. You know, it's a tough situation. And I watch the news. I see what's happening. Thankfully, in our area, it hasn't been as crazy with these people buying out everything. But yeah, I mean, there's large conglomerate companies that are coming in and buying chunks and chunks of real estate and rehabbing it and, you know, making a killing. I think in New York State, we have had some favorable laws towards the tenants and protecting them. Yeah, is it enough? I don't know.
Alex, before we were up against a break here, but I'll give you a chance to get 30 seconds in.
Yeah, no, I think the listener raised a lot of important points that it's gotten harder and harder, and we've talked about this. Sometimes you feel as if renters are paying more for a smaller space than they would if they had the resources to purchase the home. Yeah. So now, no doubt about it, I think these are real challenges.
Susan, thanks a lot. Great call. We'll take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Real Estate Today with Renata Lewis from Keller Williams Capital District and Alex Monticello of Monticello Real Estate. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Real Estate, 800-348-2551 is the number. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined by Renata Lewis and Alex Monticello, and we'll go to the email bag. Jeff writes, I am flabbergasted that your guests today have not acknowledged the impact of Airbnb on the availability of rental units. Are they not aware? Jeff, bonus points for using flabbergasted. All right, panel, what do you think?
Well, the Airbnbs, I would predict they're more of a short-term rental, you know, solution. And I don't know, I've looked at a few of them. They're not always a lot cheaper than, you know, renting or signing a lease for a year. So, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a rental option. But I think those have skyrocketed higher than any other rentals.
But I think, and I'm not sure, Jeff's point is that they're pulling the rental prices
up. Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, or they're cutting into the demand, right?
Yeah.
So there are investors who are buying properties and using them for Airbnbs, and that's taking away potential inventory.
Right. And those will be stabilized too. There's a lot of talk about just communities coming together and saying enough with the Airbnbs, and or there's going to be restrictions on how many or a percentage of homes that could potentially be permitted for that use.
You think that's crested now, or are we still seeing expansion in Airbnb?
I don't know what's the stock market doing today. It's so hard to say.
All right.
I don't think it's crested. I think Airbnb will continue to be an avenue or an opportunity, and you know, it can even be a means that some people use to like support themselves, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know, the whole gig economy, you know, Airbnb, Uber, right? These are kind of pretty incredible pieces of software, right, that have changed the way people can generate revenue.
This email from Margot in Lenox. One thing that impacts the rental market, investment groups. Okay, we talked about this. Investment groups buying single family residences. Personally, says Margot, I think that we should be legislating this trend as it severely limits the pool of affordable housing and rental units. We don't talk about this enough. And I think you two, where do you stand? Do you want more regulations or do you want to let the market work it out? Clearly, rents are pretty high.
Yeah. I mean, regulations are good, and there's got to be also an opportunity for a landlord to also have some good guidelines. I think that we're at a position where a landlord has less rights than a tenant in many cases. And you know, whether it's good or bad. It's hard because the guidelines, yes, they need to be in place, but they really should be a 50-50 favor, and I don't think it is at any one point.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Real Estate Today, kind of a different sort of a vibe on today's program with Alex Monticello and Renata Lewis. Let's go back to nuts and bolts here. When you two are representing a buyer, do you go on a walkthrough with your client, or do you say, all right, there's the house, go?
Oh, no, we need to go in for a walkthrough.
All right, now, that's what I thought. What is the practiced eye looking for that the average first-time home buyer is not?
We talk about the major mechanicals. We talk about, I always tell my buyers, your basement and your roof is your top big ticket items that we need to check out to make sure and at least have the knowledge of, do we need to budget for anything when we purchase this home? You know, how is the basement, the foundation of the house? Is it strong? Is there anything that needs to be fixed? Is it bowing? Is it cracked? And then we're looking at the plumbing, we're looking at the furnace, we're looking at the AC units, and then we're looking at the roof. Make sure that that's all in good place. And if it's not, it's okay, as long as we're having a conversation about it and they know that they need to potentially budget in the near future.
Alex, when you are walking through with a potential buyer, is there ever that time where maybe it's a first timer or maybe someone has rose-colored glasses where they are in love with the house and you say, whoa, we got to talk?
Yeah, I always like to challenge the clients that I'm working with to make sure, you know, they understand the decision they're making and they're comfortable with it. And I'll oftentimes, when I'm working with a buyer, I'll understand what their top 10 criteria is. And I like to remind them, look, you're never going to get all top 10. You're never going to get all top 5. But if you get 3 out of the top 5, that could be a good sign that maybe this is a house worth considering. Once I know their criteria, if they then are trying to match up houses that go against that criteria, I'll challenge them on it just to make sure they're making the right decision. I always like to remind, you know, my clients, buyers, sellers, there's so many opportunities within a contract, right, for a buyer to get cold feet and back out. I think it's really important before the buyer even makes that offer that they, you know, they feel confident and comfortable that this is the right decision for them.
What happens if a seller gets cold feet? Does that ever happen?
Seller really doesn't have a lot of opportunity to get cold feet. I mean, the only time a seller can unilaterally cancel the contract, at least in the contract we use here, is during the attorney review period, which typically is the first 3 to 5 business days. But once that period closes, the seller at that point is kind of along for the ride. They can say no, right? They can say no to an extension. They can say no to a credit during the inspection. But the seller at that point can never say, I'm canceling the contract.
I don't know about that. I'm going to challenge you on that.
Great. Give
See,
me
she is wound up today after all.
Well, in New York State, a seller technically doesn't have to sell the house even if they have a full asking price offer. If they change their mind and they don't want to move.
That's not what I said. I said once the attorney review period closes, there is no ability for a seller to unilaterally cancel an executed contract.
Right.
If they found a million bucks in a wall.
They can get sued if they do, but no one can kick a seller out of their house. And New York State protects the seller. If you change your mind and you're not going to move, you can cancel the contract.
No.
Yet there will be repercussions for sure.
Yeah, right. The seller would be in breach of the contract,
yes.
And then
yes.
they would be sued.
Yes.
Right.
This is getting feisty. Yeah. This is good. This was as close to an argument as I've ever seen you two have.
Is correct. Per the contract terms, the sellers have less loopholes than the buyers. Yet, ultimately, like, you cannot force a seller out of their home if they don't want to sell. Period. End of story.
If they strike oil in the backyard at the last day.
It's never happened. Knock on wood. I've had buyers cancel contracts. And, you know, sellers too, but at the time where they are able to because they don't want to extend a contract.
All right. Okay. You fancy some high finance here? Here's this email from Mike in Western Massachusetts. Subject heading. Retirement funds versus real estate investment question. Could you please give me your thoughts on the following scenario? And it's about 9 paragraphs. So here we go. A 65-year-old retired couple has about a quarter of their total wealth tied up in their home. Their investments meet their needs, but they wouldn't want to live on much less. They would like to sell, and this is like an SAT question. They would like to sell and move to a house worth 50% more than their existing home to spend the next 15 years or so, knowing that eventually they would sell again to relocate to a less costly apartment or townhouse in their later years. Would it make sense to draw from the retirement to make up the difference, assuming they could eventually reclaim a sum when the house is sold? Or should they look at a new mortgage or a combination of the two? Or should they give up on the fancier house? And that's from Mike in Western Massachusetts. Did you follow any of that?
A little bit.
Okay.
There's, I think, a very simple formula to think about, right, when you're borrowing or investing money. And the question becomes, what does that money cost to borrow? Right. What's the interest rate?
Right.
And what does that money make? Right. In your investments, I would think that they probably should not borrow from their retirement account if their retirement account is making 8, 9, 10%. Obviously not this year, but generally over the lifespan of that account, probably better off not borrowing from that and instead borrowing. Through a loan. Now, the loan could be a mortgage. It could be a home equity line of credit on their current home, which they can get some really good rates at. So from a financial point of view, financial arbitrage point of view, you're probably better off taking out a loan versus borrowing from your retirement.
I understood virtually nothing of what you just said. Renata, what do you think?
I do agree. I think especially at being at that age of 65, I believe you said.
Yep.
I would think that because they have a retirement plan in place, it's been accruing. I mean, the longer you have that retirement plan in the works, the more money you're making on it. So if you're pulling money at that age, that return on the investment, I think, is not going to be a really good one or in order to put it into a home. So I would say if their dream is to get into a bigger home, do it, mortgage it. And then when you're ready, again, it's hard to predict what that market's going to be like in the next 10 years. In a perfect storm, as long as the market's good and you could resell the home for more money, it's awesome. Yet, I would say leave that money in the retirement program.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Real Estate Today. Let's go to Olive Bridge. Ryan, you're on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just want to know what your thoughts are on how, in addition to Airbnb, zoning has impacted the cost of housing. It seems to monopolize single family and raise the minimum lot size, which many people can't afford the taxes on higher lot sizes. And also there are many ordinances in the Mid-Hudson Valley, especially southern counties, that target, no trailers and just houses they just don't want to look at. And this is, to me, been a big cost on housing, especially for entry-level homes. What are your thoughts on that?
Renata.
Yes, I agree to a point. So with the zoning, I just think a lot has changed because of the big migration from the big city into that area. And if anything, it protected the subdivision of the properties, which is a good thing. I can't really comment on, the mobile homes and things like that. I guess why that went into place would be a big, question, sitting in a town hall and see why that came into effect.
Yeah.
I don't have much more to say.
All right, Alex.
No, I think it's a complicated issue, and I think there's no doubt about it that zoning and regulation plays into this, with respect to siting of affordable housing, and the more restrictions that come into place, generally speaking, the more that's going to add to the cost of building and owning a home.
All right. Well, Ryan, you want to follow up real quick?
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of people are for affordable housing, but when push comes to shove and there's houses like a ranch or something that's going to be developed next to them, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult to get it going. It's difficult enough to get wedding centers and old dilapidated dairy farms up here in Ulster County, let alone a subdivision of affordable homes. I mean, yeah, people are moving up here from the city, but that's been going on a very long time. And zoning is relatively new. It's only been around since the 1980s in many towns up here. Some towns don't have them, and I don't feel like any scientific thing has been done to weigh the benefits and the cost of zoning and the opportunity cost in any kind of methodical way. And it's the time has come.
Well, thank you, Ryan. Is that really true? Zoning really has not been around for 100 years?
Well, I think it's all based on the municipality. Some municipalities have adopted it for many, many decades, and others, and it sounds like in Ulster County, it's a much newer adoption.
Okay. I mean, the communities need to get together and they need to go to these town hall meetings. I feel like a lot is said a lot in many cases and not much is done. So communities have to come together. What do we want in this community? We've been here for a long time. Let's protect it. That really benefits us. And, you know, school districts and busing and all of that comes into play when it comes to, you know, just, you know, upticking the people that are moving in, and there's just a lot of different variations.
And I think the caller has a good point. If you've got zoning regulations that are from the 80s or the 90s, right, there's a lot of change that has happened in these communities in the last 10, let alone 20 years, right?
Yeah.
You know, after 9/11,
infrastructure,
COVID,
all of that, everything, yeah.
There's with an influx of people moving in. So there's no doubt that I think every community would benefit from a reevaluation.
All right, let's go and grab at least one more here before we wrap it up with Renata Lewis and Alex Monticello. Ariel's in Napanoc. Ariel, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
So I have a historic house here. It was part of Yamanouchi Resort, built in 1913, an old log house. And I'm really curious if, and I, it's too much for me right now, so I'm moving along. And I'm curious if there's a particular place to engage with potential buyers who might value the historic nature of the property as opposed to wanting to, you know, demolish things and build something totally new.
That's a good question. All right. What do you think, Alex?
Well, you know, generally speaking, you know, I recommend whether it's a historic home or a modern condo, right, advertising on the major listing portals. That's where, you know, buyers from all around the country are going to go to search for properties in your area. You know, there are, and you can talk to local realtors, you know, local trade publications or organizations that may, you know, focus more on historic homes. But generally speaking, the major portals are going to be where you're probably going to have the widest reach and get the broadest amount of traffic.
Well, this is a great question. Renata, I'm not sure actually it's a great question, but if Ariel sells this home and she feels really strongly that this has to be maintained in the historic way, maybe it's not on the historic registry and then there are not rules attached to it, can she vet the buyers regardless of price? We only have about a minute.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because fair housing comes into play and you need to make sure that you can't discriminate against somebody that may want to turn it into an Airbnb and change it all around. So unless it is a historical preservation, you know, stamped home, it's really hard to know who's going to purchase it and the use that they're going to take on. You know, there's a lot of social media, you know, whether it's Facebook or, you know, I don't want to name all them, but there is a lot of communities that you could become a member of and that belong to this and they love older architecture and maybe try to sell it through them in that case. But yet you can't really protect the use. You just don't know what people are going to do.
All right, Ariel, thanks a lot. Do you both still actively engage in the social media? I mean, are you selling with that or are you using
that? I'm on TikTok, man.
You're on the TikTok? My kids like the TikTok.
I didn't do the TikTok yet.
Really? I mean, what are you going to do with the TikTok in a real estate world?
I'm ticking and I'm talking. You know what I'm saying?
I have to find you.
All right. Well, you know, I don't like the social. I like the anti-social media.
There
and that's
go.
What we are here today. Yeah. And alas, we're done with the show. Hey, Renata and Alex, thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Ray. Long live radio.
Another couple of minutes. We have another one booked, right? In this fall?
I think we do.
I have to check the big calendar. If not, we'll talk to you soon enough.
Sounds good.
Support comes from Baba Louie's Pizza, Great Barrington and Hudson, keeping comfort food available with indoor or outdoor dining and takeout. Thursday through Monday, al fresco dining in Garden Courtyard in Great Barrington, babalouiespizza.com. Pelham Auto Service, Route 9 at the Amherst Belchertown line at the sign of the Flying Pig. Worker-owned and operated service, repairing foreign cars since 1972. PelhamAuto.com. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, offering fine artist materials on custom picture framing in Rhinebeck at New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. Once again, thanks to Alex Monticello and Renata Lewis. I'm still doing the show, people. Stop talking. That's okay. You're having fun. You kids have your fun. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Andrea Cunliffe. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's wicked exciting when we do the Science Forum. At least in theory, we'll find out for sure tomorrow at 2.